Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We've been debating this since the era of Ronald Reagan. When we cut the tax rates in 2017, guess what? Revenue went up.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul on Fox Business last week talking about tax cuts doing the opposite of what you think.
There is no debate about this. The facts are in. Cutting tax rates did not lose and cause the deficit to get worse. Cutting tax rates actually created economic growth and more revenue came in. So the opposite happens a lot of times when you raise taxes. If you raise the tax rates on corporations, you'll get less productivity and less revenue. So we need to have this debate in a full-throated way, but the Democrats still can't admit that cutting taxes actually increases revenue because it increases economic growth.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Yeah, for the most part, the surprises came more so on the world side of things than they did on the more domestic side of things.
Mike Lung, Director of Brokerage with Allendale on the World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report from USDA.
The WASD reports have been relatively out of the market's mind with everything going on the more macro side of things. And now we get a WASD report that gives us a little bit more to play with long-term estimates. So you had what came in here for a domestic side of things, more of a bullish type of picture for wheat and soybeans on the old crop side of things, soybeans for the new crop side of things as well. But corn, old crop and new crop, was a bearish number. Came in with a 1.485 billion bushel carryout for the old crop corn number and a 1.4 for the new crop with an expectations of a 1.34. So a little bit more bearish on that side of things. And really for the cotton side of things, a very neutral report. They did absolutely nothing to this cotton on this report except to raise the average farm price with what's been happening on the board side of things and how elevated we've kept this cotton price on the board. So outside of that, that's really the only change domestically for the cotton side of things. And when we get to the world side of things, extremely large number coming out here for corn on the new crop number, coming in at 310, expecting 305, and even came a little bit outside the top end estimate, and a little bit higher for the beans as well, old and new. You did have South America's production upped for both Argentina and Brazil, corn and beans. And on the world side of things for the cotton side, really not a whole lot. They did adjust production slightly higher, but they was also and also slightly lower consumption on the world side of things, but nothing too huge, nothing too shocking for the cotton on this report.
USDA also revising their wheat numbers down again, 7% from last year.
If I remember correctly, last year was the lowest planting area that we have seen for winter wheat. So we this year did see a little bit of an uptick in planting area, but we are coming off of that very low number and coming off of really just a very competitive wheat market, and with us trying to build a little bit more of share in that with everything that's been going on the world side.
But there are longer-term concerns for wheat involving the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP.
It definitely is, especially with that story of building the wheat acres and where prices remain above double digits. We had the USDA come out and say give certain exemptions for land that is in the final year of CRP before the expiration of their contracts, being able to go out there and plant. And while they said it late May, which kind of it takes the wind out of the sails for potentially adding more corn acres or more bean acres, but it really gives the idea with as long as we've had wheat prices elevated, with how much profitability is there, taking that ability to plant it to this next winter wheat crop later this year and potentially seeing a lot of wheat acres, especially the longer we keep prices elevated as they are, seeing a lot of wheat acres added in the next year.
One of the next questions is whether or not we're seeing demand destruction at these levels.
Once you start to see supply start to be able to ramp back up and we have demands starting to curtail at these higher levels, it's definitely something that you can see longer term implications, much like what we saw after the fall off of 2012, where from 2013-14 on to 2020, we had this more suppressed market.
Mike Lung is Director of Brokerage with Allendale. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
My name's Courtney Schultz. I'm a professor of forest and natural resource policy at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado, and I also lead our university's climate adaptation partnership.
She testified recently before a Senate Ag subcommittee on drought and water.
At CSU, our land-grant university, we are undertaking extensive work related to climate change. We are truly at the forefront of research on fire, researching resilience of the built environment to natural disasters like fire, climate adaptation strategies in forests and rangelands, post-fire issues in Colorado and across the West with a focus on rural and indigenous communities, examining wildfire impacts on forest, snowpack, stream flow, and sediment yield. And we collaborate with USDA extensively on these efforts and appreciate the partnership with the agency's research arms. Others at our university are working on climate smart agriculture, soil-based climate solutions, sustainable livestock systems, and agrivoltaics innovation. We're home to the Partnership on Air Quality, Climate, and Health, whose members are studying smoke and, importantly, smoke communication to protect human health. We are also growing partnerships with USDA climate hubs related to drought and adaptation planning, and these are core activities of our extension efforts at CSU. And we're developing educational opportunities that would serve the existing workforce, train new graduate students, and train and recruit youth into these fields. I want to highlight a few potential areas for future attention and investment. We see potential for augmenting funding for climate adaptation research and possibly for more land-grant USDA climate hub partnerships, perhaps with multi-year funding to support partnerships for agriculture and forest resilience. There also may be value in exploring authorizing the climate hubs. A recent five-year review of the hubs indicated that there's significant demand for their work and a lot of areas for growth. For forest and fire management, which is my area of expertise, the situation will only get worse, and it's far more expensive to respond reactively than it is to work proactively. Thinning and reintroducing beneficial fire in forests can reduce fire hazard near communities. It can give firefighters greater opportunities to engage fire as it moves towards the interface where people live, and can serve to reduce fire intensity, which can protect the forest ecosystem for the benefits it provides, including water provisioning and carbon storage. At the same time, the best way to protect communities is to work on defensible space and fuel reduction right around homes because embers can come from miles away. And most ignitions are actually human-started on private land. So if we're trying to protect communities, work needs to be done across jurisdictions with strong community-based partner engagement. Partners have noticed that forest management in high-priority areas would require a $40 to $60 billion investment across jurisdictions in the next 10 years and must rely on federal, state, tribal, NGO, and private partnerships to accelerate action. We got partway there in the infrastructure bill, and I would encourage you to continue seeking the necessary funding with a few recommendations. Partners are seeking greater involvement, transparency, and accountability for how these funds are being spent to ensure they're going to the intended purpose, being placed strategically, utilizing community-based partnerships, promoting carbon storage, and going to areas that have been historically underserved. I would recommend a clear plan specifically for the funding in the infrastructure bill that is dedicated to prescribed fire, which is an essential forest management tool, and a transparent discussion of how to deploy funds where they're needed most, given current workforce shortages and limited industry capacity to do restoration work. I'd also be happy to work with you on how future investments can be guided through improved performance measures that focus on outcomes, such as more emphasis on the acres mitigated target with strong external oversight and engagement. In light of the impacts of a changing climate, the challenge of managing our connected forests, watersheds, and farmlands is monumental in Colorado and across the West.
Courtney Schultz, Associate Professor, Colorado State University. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It's the same organism in post as in post-weaning BRD.
Kansas State veterinarian Dr. Greg Hanselcheck.
It's a Mannheimia, the Pasteurella, or the bacteria. Of the viruses, we typically see BRSV and now corona. For us, corona is the primary virus that we isolate out of the out of these outbreaks. And I know producers know that corona is a major player in neonatal scours. This is a different corona genetically. And there's controversy out there. Is this corona actually a pathogen for respiratory disease or not? In the diagnostic lab at K-State, we believe it is. We have to know what those organisms are first before we can design any type of program.
And if BRD's in the herd, what do we do?
Well, if they have it in their own herd, the first thing they need to do is find out what the predominant organisms are. So if If they're unfortunate enough to have any deads, then for sure have them necropsy, you'd have some diagnostics completed on them. But there's some really good tests that can be completed on live calves by taking nasal swabs and just seeing if what bacteria, what viruses actually are there in the upper respiratory tract. And then from there, as always, they need to follow their veterinarian's advice on what treatment and what prevention program to be on.
So how important is having that vaccination plan?
They're not vaccinating for whatever predominant organism they find in their outbreak, then it's not going to help them this year. But for next year, they probably should add that to their vaccine program. And then the other thing is timing. Sometimes we need to time our vaccination in the calves to better match when we expect the outbreak. And some herds have changed that to maybe later on in the pasture season. That's when they vaccinate, and that seems to help. Some of the most successful things that we've seen in herds that have actually prevented this is instead of estrus synchronization, bringing everybody in the same pen, or even processing, bringing everybody in the same pen, they'll work them in small groups. And so it reduces the concentration of the organisms the calves are exposed to, and that seems to help a lot. The vaccination thing is really frustrating. There is no corona vaccine for respiratory disease, and so producers are trying to use the scour vaccine to help prevent the respiratory corona. Some are going to autogenous vaccines. Those things are just hit and miss, but those management things seem to help a bunch if we're talking about synchronization and processing.
One method of control is practicing good habits.
We've had several herds that routinely, if they had a calf that died from dystocia or neonatal scours, they would go to a neighbor or they would go to the sale barn, purchase a calf, graft it on the cows. We know that's a biosecurity risk. And once those herds stop doing that, it may be anecdotal, it may just be the way it is, but those herds, several herds that I can think of, actually had no problems after that, after they quit bringing in outside calves. That's our recommendation, is biosecurity and then working trying to reduce the exposure to the calves, so which means biosecurity, smaller groups, less concentration.
So when it comes to BRD, what's the takeaway message?
Key points are, if you have an outbreak, you need to know what the predominant organism is. And then from there, again, decide, is there a way that, is there something we can do to enhance the immune system of the calves? So that goes to primarily vaccination programs in the cows or the calves. And then those other things that we talked about, maybe our management, the way we're handling these calves and trying to not concentrate them all together with the adult cows.
Talking BRD, bovine respiratory disease. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The barometer plummeted sharply this month to a reading of 99 from last month's 121 as producer sentiment really turned quite negative this month.
Talking about the Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer, Dr. Jim Mintert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture.
The index of current conditions fell, as did the index of future expectations. Current conditions actually fell 26 points from a month ago, while the future expectation index fell 21 points from a month earlier. To better understand the change in sentiment that took place this month, it's useful to take a look at one of the underlying questions we use each month to compute the barometer index. One of those questions is, would you say that your farm operation today is better off, worse off, or about the same financially compared to a year ago? And notice how the percentages changed in May versus what they were in April. The percentage of people responding worse off jumped from 38% last month to 54% in May, while the percentage saying that they were better off declined from 23% in April to just 14% in May. Some of the other questions we use to capture farmer sentiment also had sharp changes this month compared to the prior month, and really reveals the change in sentiment that took place from April to May. The Farm Financial Performance Index declined again this month to a reading of 81. That's down pretty sharply from last month when it was 95. And notice how negative that Farm Financial Performance Index has been in 2022 versus where it was in 2021. January through May questions of this year, of course, refer to 2022 compared to 2021, whereas previously we were focused on 2021 performance compared to 2020. Clearly, producers are expecting worse financial performance in 2022 compared to 2021. The Farm Capital Investment Index really didn't change much this month. It dropped 1 point to a reading of 35 versus 36 last month. But one change was 50% of the producers this month said their purchase plans have been impacted by low farm machinery inventory levels. That compares to 41% that said that last month. And truthfully, about 40 to 42 or 3% has been the range of responses we've received to that question over time. So this was a more negative response with respect to the impact of farm machinery inventory levels. Despite the weak Farm Financial Performance Index rating, producers remained relatively optimistic about farmland values. The long-term farmland value index rose 8 points this month to a reading of 149 compared to 141 last month. And the short-term index also rose, although it was a small movement of just 1 point. If you look at those, both of those indices, however, they remain significantly below where they were last fall, suggesting farmers do think the peak might be behind us. Producers who tell us they expect to see farmland values rise over the next 5 years continue to tell us they think the number one factor influencing those farmland values will be non-farm investor demand, followed by inflation. We continue to ask producers what's taking place on their farms with respect to farm input prices. 43% of the producers in this month's survey said they expect to see farm input prices in 2022 to wind up 40% or more higher than they were in 2021. Looking ahead to the 2023 crop season, roughly 1 out of 5 producers said that they expect to see an additional rise in those farm input prices of 20% or more. Once again this month, we asked producers what their biggest concerns are for their farming operation in the upcoming year. 43% of the producers in this month's survey said high input prices is their number one concern, followed by availability of inputs. Their third concern was lower crop or livestock prices, but it's interesting to note that high input prices is much higher ranked by producers than lower crop or livestock prices.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're in, you know, new territory across the board. And, you know, I think the headlines for 2021 in China's purchases of U.S. ag products is dominated by failed to meet the Phase 1 trade agreement. You know, we haven't heard about the Phase 1 trade agreement in quite a while. I'm not sure where that fits into the broader narrative of where we are here in the going into the summer of 2022.
David Widmar is co-founder of Agricultural Economic Insights online at aei.ag, talking about Chinese purchases for corn and beef.
But the reality here is China purchased a record amount of goods and services from the U.S., ag goods and services, about $36 billion worth in 2021. That's about $7 billion or 25% higher than the year before and about the same from the record that we set almost a decade ago. And so what we saw during the trade war is activity fell significantly, somewhere around $14 billion. During 2020, we got back to sort of pre-trade war highs, and then we set a whole new level here. And as we've dug into that total, there are two commodities that stand out for really driving that $7 billion in new purchases. It's beef and corn. And while those two might not surprise you, the magnitude of purchases that we saw of those two commodities is, you know, pretty unbelievable. So a little context here. We bought about, China purchased about $6.7 billion worth of U.S. beef and corn in 2021. If you add up the 11 preceding years of beef and corn purchases, you get to about $5.5 billion. So they purchased more in 2021 of those two commodities than they had purchased in the 11 preceding years altogether. And so the rapid change and the magnitude here of what we've seen, it's pretty remarkable.
So are we seeing these exports increase because of more demand, or is it for more market share?
There are several things going on there, and that's a really great question, Tony. And, you know, one thing that's going on is China's consumers are purchasing more beef. And so that's been playing out for a few years now. The U.S. has been a very, very small market share. And so we're seeing the market grow. The pie is expanding. The U.S. is now growing in market share. So we have the U.S. has two things going there. We're gaining market share in a market that's growing. That's really exciting. And one other note here, China's purchases of beef almost beat out their purchases of U.S. pork. And so pork has had decades of, you know, trying to build that relationship, and beef just kind of came up out of nowhere and quickly came sort of to the forefront of meat trade with China.
In the past, the Chinese have eaten beef bowl, but what about the potential for more muscle cuts?
From the level of the data that I have access to look at this, we don't have really great granularity as to how they're cutting that out. I suspect it will take us a little bit of time to get that more detailed data available through different trade partners. But you're right. There are changes going on here that are starting to make, significant differences in the Chinese appetite. And one change that I'll mention here is it looks like the upward trend of consuming more pork has paused. And so it's not necessarily that they're eating more meat in total. There's a substitution between pork and beef going on here that's starting to impact these trends as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I'm Dr. Ellen Herbert, Senior Scientist for Ducks Unlimited, North America's leader in voluntary incentive-based wetland and grassland conservation.
Testifying recently before a Senate Ag Subcommittee on the Western Water Crisis.
Water is at the center of what we do as an organization. Western states have lost between 20 and 90% of their original wetlands through direct drainage and conversion of wetlands. Others have been lost through the diversion of source water for other uses. It will come to no surprise that drought is further exacerbating wetland loss. This has had a profound effect on water birds and other wetland-dependent wildlife, as well as the important ecological functions wetlands provide to people by capturing floodwater, augmenting river flows, recharging deep aquifers, and regulating climate. The drought situation is dire. However, I want to offer solutions on the role of Farm Bill programs and other programs like the National Wetlands Conservation Act. Wetland restoration in states like Colorado and Kansas can be part of the drought mitigation solution. We've heard from other witnesses about flow retiming. Wetlands with subsurface connectivity tend to regulate hydrology by capturing water during snowmelt or flood periods and direct that water through shallow subsurface flows, providing a constant subsurface discharge to streams and rivers during drought periods. Do you and other multiple partners in public and private entities deliver the South Platte River wetland augmentation wetlands in Colorado to direct water to wetland ponds during high flow? These projects offset agricultural well depletion, supplement base flow during dry periods, and provide habitat for waterfowl, wading birds, cranes, and other threatened and endangered species. Wetlands can also play a role in recharging deep aquifers. DU works with USDA through the SAFE program and other partners in the Southern High Plains to restore playa wetlands. As the ranking member knows too well, the Ogallala Aquifer is being depleted at an alarming rate. But scientists estimate that aquifer recharge rates in playa wetlands are 10 to 1,000 times higher than recharge rates in upland systems, and playa wetlands contribute up to 95% of the aquifer recharge. By restoring functional playas, we can improve water security for future generations and provide important migratory bird habitat. These playas, among other CRP wetlands, are also the subject of a newly funded USDA project led by DU and partners from USGS, ARS, and 6 state and tribal universities examining the climate mitigation potential of the CRP program. Previous research indicates these wetlands and surrounding grasslands are important carbon reservoirs. Water efficiency is another important component of drought resilience, especially in arid western states where it can be difficult to supply enough water to support a significant human population, globally important agriculture industry, and vital habitat for waterfowl and other wildlife. The Klamath Basin Irrigation Project, for instance, supports tens of thousands of wetland acres and hundreds of thousands of acres of cropland, requiring 440,000 acre-feet of water annually. This year is slated to receive only 50,000 acres, or 11% of that demand. Lower Klamath and Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuge, once the most important waterfowl refuges in North America, will receive no water and be completely dry. In a typical winter, the Central Valley of California hosts between 6 and 8 million ducks and geese, which rely on wetlands and winter-flooded rice. This year, rice planting will be around half of what it normally is. Rice is an important commodity and provides more than half of all waterfowl food in the Central Valley. The rest of the wetlands of the Central Valley of California are slated to get 20% of less than normal water supplies. While there is no single solution other than increased snowpack and more rain, which is becoming increasingly unlikely with changing weather patterns and warmer winters, we can implement more water-efficient practices to better use what we have.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The latest complete ag trade numbers we have are for April, a month in which the U.S. exported $17.6 billion worth of ag products, imported almost the same amount of foreign products.
It was the largest value of agricultural exports and agricultural imports for any other April on record.
USDA economist and trade tracker Bart Kenner says for the first 7 months of this fiscal year, October through April,
agricultural exports were $119.4 billion, up 12%.
That's those high product prices showing up because in general, as far as bulk commodities, actual shipment volumes are down. For example,
wheat, which was up 11% in value from last year, was down 22% by volume. Corn, up 17% by value, is down 4% by volume.
We're seeing volume declines also for soybeans, cotton, rice, many other products, but the export values keep climbing, heading for a projected record this fiscal year, $191 billion. Gary Crawford, Washington.